Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, September 27th. This is our weekly news roundup, and we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio is Sarah Mizestan, our very own reporter. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
And joining us later in the program, we'll be speaking with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent, and Will Sennett at the Vineyard Gazette. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. Jeff, let me start with you. The governor issued a four-month ban on vaping products on Tuesday, and this seemed to catch plenty of folks by surprise. Tell us how the ban was announced and what's behind it.
Yeah, sure. This happened at about 2 o'clock on Tuesday, and when the governor announced that there would be a four-month temporary ban on the sale of all vape products. That includes the devices used in addition to the cartridges or the what they call the juice that goes into them. The reason being that there has been an uptick in the number of cases of lung disease that has been observed throughout the United States, but also here in Massachusetts, where there's been 61 cases. So it did catch a lot of folks here by surprise, people throughout the state. Part of the surprise was, well, how do we enforce this? It went into effect, and it appeared as if there was no heads up given to any of the health departments, at least here on the Cape.
It sounded like they were hearing it Tuesday afternoon, kind of just with everybody else.
They heard it at the same time we did. And so what we did on Tuesday afternoon, right when we heard that the ban went into effect, is went out and spoke with a few of the owners of some of these stores, and they had no idea
how to comply with this. What do we do?
Jeff, sounds like we've gotten you back on the tie line, which is great. We've got you. It sounds like you're right there with us. Let me jump in here with Sarah Mizestan, who's in the studio with us. Sarah, you went out Wednesday talking to folks about this vape ban. In fact, you were in a vape shop on Wednesday morning when a town health agent arrived essentially to deliver an order shutting them down.
Yeah. You know, as Jeff was saying, I think a lot of these business owners were definitely taken by surprise by how long this ban is going to be lasting and just how overarching it is. I think the owner, Eric Tarvin, I went to VapeCod, and he mentioned that they had a sense that something was coming down the line, but they didn't think that it would be this strong and far overreaching. But we were there right at the moment that...
His sense that it was overreaching.
Yes, definitely. Let's clarify there. His sense that it was overreaching. But I was there right at the moment that they were forced to close. I'd been talking with employees shortly after they opened their doors on Wednesday morning. They were telling me they'd be continuing to sell their products until they were told to close. And unfortunately, maybe they spoke too soon, as the health inspector was maybe the third customer in the door that day.
Mm-hmm. And there were customers there essentially trying to stock up, right? People knew this was coming, and folks were hitting the vape shops trying to make the most of this.
Definitely, yeah. Lots of people coming in trying to buy all of their products and store up for the next 4 months. And then, of course, we had a couple angry people who came in right after the health inspector who were very upset that they would not be able to get their products there.
Jeff, obviously this is a health issue and there are a lot of unanswered questions mm-hmm. around vaping, which prompted this. But for small business owners, big economic hit here.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and I should also mention, Sarah, I was at the Vape Cod in Hyannis when they were told to close as well. So we were in parallel paths here. But yes, I spoke with one owner of a store here in Hyannis who, after the town of Barnstable back on July 29th, put in some regulations for flavored tobacco products and vaping products and said you have to have, they can only be sold in a store that allows folks 21 years and older to come in. So this particular gentleman actually opened up a brand new store on Barnstable Road in Hyannis, spent $100,000 to open the store. And I went in, I had to be the unfortunate person to tell him that the ban went into effect. Mm. And it was just like, oh my, you know? And he told me that as of that moment on Tuesday afternoon, he had approximately $20,000 worth of inventory of vaping products.
I guess there's also questions here about people who vape users, and mm-hmm. what happens. There's been a lot of talk about them being forced to the black market by this ban or to return to smoking cigarettes, I guess. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about that, Jeff?
Yeah, well, when I was at Vape Cod, when the health inspector came in, there was a woman who was there. She had quit smoking after 35 years, has been vaping for 5 years, and was actually at the cash register waiting to buy a coil for her vaping device, which never happened because we had walked in. But she was concerned. She said, I really don't want to go back to cigarettes. I don't like the smell. I don't want to burn holes in my clothes. So you got to wonder how many of these people are going to go after products that are in the black market, which, as we know, are manufactured in unregulated environments. And a lot of people don't know what's in them and think that the root of all of the disease and the health problems we're seeing now may actually be coming from these products.
Mm.
And I did speak with a thoracic surgeon who is very involved in this on the Cape. His name is Jeff Spillane.
We were noticing that at the newsroom. Your source was Jeff Spillane, yes.
Yeah, which is a little odd. We have the J&G differential there. But he is very concerned. And he said he's been seeing a lot of lung inflammation, what he calls vape cough, as well as several other things. But he said a lot of this is we just don't know what's in some of these products people are putting into their lungs and what the long-term health effects are.
Sarah, you also were speaking with some customers who had obviously strong reaction to being told that they can't buy these products now for 4 months or they have to look elsewhere for them.
Yeah, definitely. I spoke with a number of people who mentioned that they had friends or relatives who had been obviously using vape products to kind of wean themselves off of cigarettes. And a lot of people who mentioned that they had friends who, you know, had been previously addicted to alcohol or drugs and were kind of using vaping as their crutch to kind of help them get over that addiction. Yeah. And so there is definitely some concern that these people might end up going back to some of those things they were trying to overcome with this vaping ban.
At the same time, let me jump in. At the same time, the local health agents were almost unanimous in coming out in support of this and saying this was a bold move, but the right move by the governor.
Definitely. Yeah, it is not, you know, I think it's tricky, I think. You know, you definitely don't want to be telling opioid addicts who are trying to get over their disease that what they're trying to kind of help themselves with is also bad for them. That's a really tricky situation.
Yeah.
But yeah, at the same time, it is definitely something that has had some adverse health effects.
And 61 reported cases of illnesses from vaping supposedly in the state here in Massachusetts.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. 9 deaths around the country, I think.
And I had asked Dr. Splain that as well. I said, how are any one of those 61 cases, they've been reported here on the Cape and Islands? He said, well, I'm not sure exactly how they're tracking this, but he said, I have certainly treated one child with some severe lung damage.
Mm.
One thing I also wanted to mention here, as surprised as some of the health agents were that this ban went into effect, the county was as well, because 14 out of the 15 towns here in Barnstable County have a contract with the county to enforce tobacco regulations. That department has one employee, and he was on vacation this week.
He was on vacation this week. They
he
picked a heck of a
Aruba.
Week. Yeah, a heck of a week to do this for in terms of the county enforcement and sort of supplying support to the local health boards, you can imagine, as they're trying to deal with this.
Yeah, they may have to hire some new inspectors, they told me.
Sarah Mises-Tan from WCAI, thanks for coming in and talking with us about this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Jeff, stay with us here. I want to ask you about the results of Massachusetts' standardized school test called the MCAS. These were released this week. What did they tell us? What did we learn here?
You know, MCAS actually stands for the Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment System. I think back in the day we used to call them college boards. It's a statewide standards test, and when the results came out Monday, the Cape looks like it finished pretty much right in the middle of the pack at the average level. And also, this was the first time this past spring that 10th graders took a new, what they're calling a next generation test in English language, arts, and math, which is considered a much more rigorous test, and it's to gauge college readiness and preparedness.
And education officials here cautioning not to draw a hard comparison between this generation of the test, like you say, as you say, this was a new generation of the test, and what students have been taking previously.
Exactly. There are four different categories that students would fall into when they get the test results back. The top two categories are meeting expectations or exceeding expectations. And statewide, about 61% in English were in those two categories. and 58 in math. And there were some interesting results here on the Cape as well.
Mm-hmm. Tell us what some of the... It's kind of a mixed bag. Obviously, it depends where you look and what kind of results come in. But give us a sense, a little bit, of across the region what we saw.
Yeah, well, there are 67 schools in the state that were recognized for high achievement. None of them were here on the Cape. As far as the English arts tests for the high school students, Sturgis Charter Public School here in Hyannis finished highest in the region with about an 88% in those two categories. Cape Cod Tech in Harwich had the lowest with less than half, about 42% in the meeting expectations or exceeding expectations. But as was said in Cindy McCormick's story, it's a technical school. It really doesn't necessarily focus on that particular area of study. So...
And the Barnstable School Superintendent, I was also cautioning here that the MCAS, these tests aren't really the be-all and end-all for evaluating what's happening within the schools, but they're a good yardstick.
Exactly. And Barnstable did finish, Barnstable, the largest school system here on the Cape, did finish a little bit above average.
Let's talk about a study that's going to be examining impacts of contaminants in drinking water in two Massachusetts towns, and one of those towns is Hyannis.
It is. This is a $1 million grant that was awarded to the Silent Spring Institute, which is based in Newton. It's been very involved here in Hyannis, educating the public about the dangers and some of the consequences of drinking water that is contaminated with PFAS. They received that $1 million federal grant to test the impact of the contamination in Hyannis, as you had mentioned, as well as Ayer, which is, I'm going to say, the north central part of the state.
It's kind of northwest of Boston, yes.
Yeah, right. Right. What this will allow Silent Spring Institute to do is to test 1,000 adults and 300 children. And of those 1,300 subjects, two-thirds will be coming from Hyannis. That's because the population of Hyannis is larger than Ayer. And also, there's been more contamination here, and has been well documented and reported. That contamination, for the most part, has come from the Barnstable County Fire and Rescue Training Academy in Hyannis, where firefighting foams containing these contaminants has been used for decades. It got into the groundwater, it got into the soil. This award came from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as a group that I had not been familiar with, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry.
Mm. This is part of an extended project. Mm-hmm. Now, this is funding for year one of what looks like it could be a five-year project.
Year one, that's right, of 5 years. And they do expect to have the same type of funding for the next 4 years. And what they're going to be doing is going out collecting blood and urine samples to test for thyroid, hormone, cholesterol, and antibody levels that they believe could be affected by exposure to these contaminants. And we've already seen two public health warnings here in Hyannis since 2015, where there had to be a warning issued for infants, pregnant women, and nursing mothers not to consume the water supply, which I have to add is considered safe right now.
And
it's treated.
Hyannis is not alone in dealing with PFAS issues across our region.
No, Mashpee has an issue, as does Joint Base Cape Cod, and most recently West Tisbury, given its proximity to the Martha's Vineyard Airport.
Mm. Hyannis has been working to address this problem on their own, sort of alongside all these studies that are going on.
And that's right. There have been carbon treatment filters put on wells, and also a big thing here is the county has, for all intents and purposes, shut down the fire academy.
Mm-hmm. And they're building a new filtration building in Hyannis there, a $12 million water filtration building to try to tackle this as well. I was kind of interested also, the study looks like it's going to be looking at the historical record, which I guess makes sense if you're trying to understand changes in impacts of people over time as their exposure to PFAS changes. They're going to be looking at historical records of water quality, it looks like.
They are, and you know, and what are the differences as to how long you've been exposed to this water and drinking it?
Jeff, you covered a story this week about Cape Cod Hospital and how it broke ground on a new building. This comes as the hospital is approaching a big anniversary.
Yeah, Cape Cod Hospital is going to be 100 years old next year in 2020. And on Monday, there was what they call a ceremonial groundbreaking. It was actually some dirt that was was taken with shovels and put on the parking lot. But at the ceremonial groundbreaking was for a new six-story patient care tower that's planned for the campus of the hospital in Hyannis. It's a $180 million project, and they're hoping it will be completed by 2022. And once the project is completed, there will be it'll be 140,000 square foot addition to the hospital. It will have new services and technology for cancer, cardiovascular, and intensive care, 40 new beds, and a lot of folks, including Sarah Peake, who's a state representative from Provincetown, were just so enthusiastic about this project, hoping it would save people a lot of trips to Boston.
And really calling it a significant increase in capacity and ability for the hospital.
Very, very much so. It's becoming a true regional health center is what Representative Crocker told me as well, who was there. I should mention that this ceremonial groundbreaking, the program, the keynote speaker for this was to be Mary Lou Sutters, who's the Secretary of Health here in the state. But it was announced on Monday afternoon that she had been called back to the State House for an announcement the governor was going to make on Tuesday. At that point, we didn't know what it was going to be, but now we do know.
That was the vaping ban.
It was.
Sort of surprised a lot of folks there.
That's right. Also, another key component of this project is the hospital is developing what they're calling a fully integrated single electronic medical record system, which I think a lot of patients are going to be very excited about.
Jeff, one more I want to ask you briefly here at the end about a story you have today in the paper, which is about a fund that offers relief for medical bills for pet owners. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, this is the Sampson Fund for Veterinary Care. Based in Orleans, even though it does not have a headquarters, this has no overhead. Many pet owners, I got to say, myself included, know how it is, a devastation when you're told your dog or cat is seriously ill. As if that wasn't bad enough, the treatment is typically extremely expensive and prohibitive for many people. So this fund was formed in the 1980s to help pet owners, specifically here on the Cape and Islands, who find themselves in this situation, to actually have some financial assistance. The fund works with 12 veterinary hospitals on the Cape, from Falmouth to Eastham, and there's one on the Vineyard as well. So when someone comes in and there's a serious injury to a cat or dog, they do only work with cats and dogs, I should mention, no birds or rabbits or anything. The hospital will contact the fund and say, we have a client here who has an emergency and needs some financial help.
Hmm.
And as the president, Patty Smith, who I spoke with yesterday, said anytime there's a surgery, you're looking at a couple thousand dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So the fund has about $85,000 to $100,000 traditionally that they use to provide financial assistance, and they're dependent on donations, grants, and fundraising events, which there is one this weekend.
And that's right. That's what I wanted to close with, the fact that there is a fundraiser this weekend to support the Sampson Fund.
That's right. It's tomorrow at 5 o'clock. It goes from 5 to 8, and it's going to be at Cape Cod Beer here in Hyannis. $15 a person, and the ticket gets you a beer as well.
And you can bring well-behaved dogs.
Well-behaved and leashed.
Okay. Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, Steve, thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us right now on the phone from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
George, you have a story about new efforts to solve a 5-year-old crime, the shooting death of a well-known West Tisbury man while he was vacationing off-island. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is Pat Gregory, and he was the town moderator in West Tisbury. And, of course, his killing just shocked the community here at the time. And, you know, a lot of time has passed. It's been 5 years now. But we got word that they're about to release a sketch nationally, and we have a copy of this on our website, of the suspected shooter. And it took a while to get this sketch into a point where investigators feel comfortable that they have, you know, something that they feel looks like the person from that time.
This is, like you said, this is 5 years after the crime. Why did it take that long to come up with a sketch that they feel comfortable with?
partially because the other person who was with Gregory at the time, also a shooting victim, but he survived, you know, was just so traumatized by the shooting that it took him a while to sort of get his bearings and be able to give a more accurate description of the person who did this. This happened in California. They were hiking in a place called Iron Canyon Trail, and that's in Tehama County. And there's been speculation through the years that perhaps they stumbled upon some illegal marijuana farms that tend to be in California. But law enforcement is saying they don't believe that that's the case. Law enforcement is particularly puzzled by this because it was a robbery. They know that from the other victim in the case. And they complied. They gave this person what he wanted, and he still shot them, killing one of them and leaving the other one for dead. And, you know, he did survive. So just particularly hard to take, you know, for the family. They didn't speak to us for this, you know, but they're aware that law enforcement does have this new sketch. And I think it's interesting that the California authorities have been working with the West Tisbury police chief, Matt Mincone, to let the family know of every step they're taking. They want people to know that even though it's been 5 years, this is in no way a cold case, and they are actively seeking the suspect in this murder.
And the law enforcement authorities from California came to the Vineyard to convey this message essentially to the family.
That's right. They wanted to make sure that the family knew that this is an important case to them, and a particularly troubling case to them, and it's something that they want to solve. So hoping for a news at some point that will, you know, obviously won't bring Mr. Gregory back, but may give the family some closure to know that, you know, this person is not getting away with this.
Let me ask you about another story you have in the paper, a nice story about the steam whistles that folks hear on the ferries to the island. These are old whistles that have been retrofitted, essentially, to these modern vessels.
Yeah, this is a really cool story. You know, people know the various whistles of the steamship. You know, I hear it every day here in the office because we're that close. Just went off right
now. I just
now.
Heard it, yes.
Yeah. Good timing there. But, yeah, you know, what I was fascinated by in this story is that some of these are antiques, you know, dating back centuries, back to 1899 in one particular case. And they survived the test of time, providing that, you know, announcement to folks that the ferry is leaving the dock and headed off, in this case, to Woods Hole, but in Woods Hole headed to the Vineyard. So, and a lot of people just find these really special. We talked to Bob Cleesby. He's the former president of the Steamship Historical Society of America, and I think he puts it very well. Its voice is its whistle, and, you know, many of these ferries have very distinctive voices. And, you know, as much as people may moan and groan about the Steamship Authority, we certainly love hearing them. You know, we can almost set our clocks by them.
George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve. Enjoy the weekend.
You too. We're going to speak next with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, the town of Chatham is bringing up a fresh idea around climate change. It's exploring whether an academic institution might set up to study climate change there and the positive impacts that that might have for the town.
Yeah, you know, Chatham is kind of especially well located for this type of study. Erosion and changes in tidal levels, you know, we talk about this all the time regarding Chatham, especially, you know, after the various breaks happened in the town's Barrier Beach between 1987 and really almost right up to the present. It's been sort of seen as a bit of a laboratory for sea level rise. Even before people were talking about sea level rise, this was kind of the case because the breaks changed the way the tidal flow was in Chatham Harbor and Pleasant Bay, increased and decreased tidal ranges, which people are, you know, scientists say that's what we're going to be expecting to see up and down the coast, you know, for the foreseeable future. But
what kind of climate research are they talking about here? What are they envisioning?
So they what they hope to do is look at is be able to entice an academic institution to look at Chatham as, like I said, sort of a laboratory for climate change study. You know, for the past 6 months, there's been a working group of town officials who have been developing a strategy to attract an academic institution to possibly open like a climate change research station is how they're terming it here in town. The way town officials see it, you know, Chatham has a lot of advantages to attract that type of an operation. You know, there's an airport for people to come in and out of. It's easy access to the water. There's a commercial fishing industry that is sort of a laboratory in itself on the changes that are coming about with the warming of the waters. And of course, the as we spoke about, the ongoing erosion and barrier beach evolution. That's being fueled by rising sea level and changing weather patterns. And just as importantly, town officials see, the intimate scale of Chatham, you know, small town, close-knit community, as being conducive for researchers to really study kind of the social impact of climate change as well, from fishermen to coastal homeowners to recreational beach users and waterways, how it affects town government, how it affects the economy. They say they've talked to about four academic institutions at this point. They didn't identify them. They say that they'll also try to bring in local connections that the town has with groups like the Center for Coastal Studies and the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy to try to form maybe sort of a, like a coalition that can focus on climate change and sea level rise specifically.
And tell us what the institution might require from the town. What does the town have to provide if they can bring about a collaboration like this?
Right. Well, what they're looking at is maybe providing a location to be able to do this out of. Docking space, maybe even a boat. Help from the Harbor Master Department, something like that. The town has a couple of buildings that are vacant right now that might serve as office or research space. There's the town, they haven't talked at all about, you know, what the cost would be on something like this. I think they're still a little far out for getting into detail like that. But they'd like to see ultimately a permanent research facility here. And one of the things they're talking about doing initially is maybe holding a symposium on climate change to bring in scientists from maybe even across the nation and who knows, maybe around the world to talk about the issue and maybe look at Chatham and see how this could really be, like we said, a laboratory for that kind of an operation.
Hmm. Interesting idea. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
And we're going to check in right now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well, Ed. Thanks for joining us. Your reporter, Sophie Rohr, has a story about calls from Provincetown residents to the health department about rat sightings in town. The article has some suggestions for how to approach the rat problem. Tell us what's happening.
Yes. Well, there's in certain neighborhoods in Provincetown, apparently there's been a noticeable increase in rats. Some residents are alarmed about this because they say they've never seen rats before in their compost and garbage cans, etc. The health department in Provincetown has put up a notice on the town website advising people that they should store their garbage in rodent-proof containers. Clean up and compost areas and anything that's uncovered that would attract rats, and also to use poison if necessary to control the rats. At the same time, the health board sponsored a talk last week by Gary Menon of an organization called Raptors Are the Solution, who argues that really a bigger problem than the rats is the use of the poison to kill them. These poisons are anticoagulants. Basically, they cause the rats to bleed to death internally. But the problem is that the poisoned rats become lethargic, making them easy prey for raptors like hawks and owls. And the birds eat the rats. They ingest the rodenticide, and then the birds die. And Executive Director Stephanie Ellis at WildCare in Eastham said that raptor poisonings have increased over the past few years, and it's very alarming, she says. So the people like Menon of Raptors Are the Solution say, don't use rodenticides. Instead, just get your garbage cleaned up so that the rats don't come looking for garbage at your house and instead are outdoors more where the raptors can get them. He says a great horned owl will eat 50 rats every month and really put a dent in the population. And that kind of natural control is better than poisoning the environment.
Do people seem receptive to the idea? I guess everyone's just trying to figure out what they need to do here.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a matter of public education. Part of the situation really is that people have a kind of emotional reaction to rats, and they naturally think that rats are dirty and, you know, carry diseases. And in fact, rats are no more dangerous or dirty than any other kind of animal, as some Sophie, our reporter, talked to a researcher at Harvard Medical School who uses rats in her research, and she says, you know, bears will forage for food in your garbage too, but nobody says a bear is dirty. She points out that rats are actually quite lovable. They're very intelligent. They're playful, she says. They're social creatures. They can learn tricks. They enjoy being tickled, and they even like to play hide and go seek.
Well, you wouldn't tell a bear it's dirty to its face, that's for sure.
No, I don't think so. But maybe we should, you know, reconsider our feelings about rats, and you know, watch that great movie Ratatouille, you know, or there's you know the public perception of rats is probably affected by you know, the history of the plague, et cetera. But luckily we don't have the plague here anymore, so we should give rats a chance.
Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks for joining us this morning.
You're welcome, Steve. Always great to be with you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us from the Vineyard Gazette is Will Sennett. Good morning, Will.
Morning, Steve.
Will, the Striped Bass and Bluefish Derby is happening now, which is cause for excitement for fishermen. You've got a story about some folks who've come to the island to sample the derby fishing, but they're not necessarily fishermen. They're veterans. Tell us about this project to bring them here.
Yeah, so it was a really great opportunity. I went out to East Beach to fish with a group of veterans. You know, and it was great. We were out there. It was right around sunset. It was really a beautiful sight. The veterans were invited by the American Heroes Saltwater Challenge. And if you're unfamiliar with it, it's a homegrown effort to provide wounded and recovering veterans a trip to the vineyard to fish in the Derby.
You spoke with two veterans in particular that are featured in your story, Tommy Alford and Miles Foltz. And they had just such a powerful story about their experiences serving in the military and then what it's meant for them to come back to the United States and try to reconcile all of that with this experience that they had.
Yeah, you know, it was really a raw experience for a lot of the veterans there, you know, being out there on the water, you know, surrounded by other veterans. But it was especially raw for Tommy Alford and Miles Foltz. They were two former specialists who haven't seen each other in 11 years before the trip. the two soldiers had been in combat together in Afghanistan when Tommy was hit by a Taliban bullet in his neck and jaw. Braving heavy fire, Miles pulled Tommy to safety, stopped the bleeding, and fended off the attack with Tommy's weapon. Two soldiers were lost that day, but Tommy survived thanks to Miles' bravery. And, you know, the story, it kind of became the center of a lot of media attention. You may even have read it in the Washington Post. You know, there's an article about Joe Biden kind of gaffing their story in his campaign trail. But the story told in the media, you know, it really often doesn't focus on the visible wounds, you know, like the scar that runs up Tommy's neck. You know, what's missing from those stories is the wounds that aren't as visible. And they told me a lot about it while we were fishing.
They told you about it, and they also talked about how useful this kind of experience is to bring the veterans together and then also to be able to talk about their experiences that they've had with each other.
Yeah, they did. They said it was really valuable to talk about their experience, you know, and it was raw. A lot of emotion that had been held down for the last 11 years came bubbling to the surface. And they said it was hard to do, but each of the veterans, you know, they agreed that going out fishing, surrounding by, and being able to talk to other veterans who have been through similar experiences, you know, they said it was a vital step in their long road to recovery.
I was interested, I was struck by, in your piece, a description of a couple of the ways that veterans, these guys have been, as you say, 11 years since they were serving overseas, but still when things happen around them, they respond viscerally and they immediately and instinctively, and there were things that happened while they were out fishing that kind of reflected their experiences serving in the military.
Yeah, you know, they said that, you know, PTSD really impacts almost every aspect of their lives still. You know, of course, they're veterans, so they're brave, and they're joking around, surprisingly open to talking about it. But, you know, you could see different manifestations of the disorder even while we were fishing. You know, for example, one of the former Marines I was with, he told me that he hit the deck when the anchor line on his fishing boat snapped. And, you know, obviously that was a knee-jerk reaction to being under fire. And, you know, another one of the vets, he said that the feeling of being out there in the open water, to him, it provoked the memory of driving a Humvee through the Afghan desert.
Mm. And one of somebody got a cut on their hand, and the fellow who had been a medic immediately sprang to action.
Yeah, yeah. He, you know, they still call him Doc, all members of his old troop. And it was kind of just like falling back into old, you know, the positions of rank, being in the military. And, you know, it really makes him happy to be able to fall into that again. And, you know, there's such a camaraderie in being in war that they told me about. And, you know, being in a fishing boat kind of can simulate that a little bit.
Will Sennett, The Vineyard Gazette. Will, thanks for joining us. It's a nice piece you have there.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Appreciate it.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. It's time now to check on action at the State House. We've had some big news out of Beacon Hill over the last few days, from the governor's announcement of a public health emergency and a ban on the sale of vaping products, to the joint proposed bill to boost education funding for public schools, which has been a long time coming. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean for the update.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
So let's talk about the big news that's just happened in the last few days, and that's the governor's declaration of a public health emergency due to the rising number of reported lung illnesses from vaping across the country. And with that comes a ban on the sale of vaping products.
Yeah, there's been 61 cases reported in the state as of a couple of days ago when Baker made that declaration. They said there were three confirmed to be related to vaping. And so this is something that's obviously happening nationwide. People are hearing about this. And this ban, I guess, it's Massachusetts' effort to just lock it down so that health experts across the country and here in Massachusetts can figure out what the connection is between vaping products and this respiratory illness that seems to be, you know, quite deadly in some cases. So, again, yeah, it's 4 months starting from, you know, this week. So vapes are illegal until January. Basically, they're coming off of store shelves. There's been a lot of reporting about retailers not quite knowing what to do, but now a couple days later, it looks like they are kind of coming off shelves. That's up to local the boards of health. So basically, the people who already enforce rules about cigarettes or other kind of tobacco products, they're the ones who are coming and either fining or confiscating products from stores that still sell these vape products.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've been hearing a lot of reaction to this. Not everyone is pleased with this. There was some criticism even from a member of the state's Cannabis Control Commission.
Yeah, Shalene Title is a member of the Cannabis Control Commission. They're the board that really has overseen the rollout of recreational marijuana in Massachusetts over the last couple of years. She has said that banning this type of vape product especially when it comes to marijuana products, because there is speculation that there's more of a connection to THC vape products potentially than to regular nicotine ones. Tidal has said that this is only going to drive people back into the black market, where there are no regulations on these types of markets and on these types of products, and it's only going to be less safe for people who are doing that. And I think she is concerned that, you know, medical marijuana user who relies on these things is not really going to shift to a different kind of marijuana product, but rather seek out a now illegal black market vape.
I want to turn to other big news that came out actually late last week, but we've been talking about it quite a bit this week as people parse out this massive bill. And it's a proposed spending package to boost education spending around the state. Tell us some highlights of this bill. It's $1.7 billion, give or take.
Yeah, the inflation number, it's over 7 years, so you can kind of give and take. It's between $1.4 and $2.2 billion, really kind of depending on what the amount of spending may be because of inflation on that seventh year, if that makes any sense, kind of over the life of this plan.
Yeah.
So we're finding an average. Yeah, I mean, it's 1.4 now. It'll probably be, you know, around that level when it goes into effect. It's a sign of what this actually is. It's a funding formula, meaning that they're not saying, here's the price tag, this is what we're going to divvy up over 7 years. They're saying, this is the formula that we're going to give out no matter what. So the state's commitment here is expected to be $1.5 billion over 7 years, but it could be as high as, you know, over $2 billion, and the state would be committed to doing that. So that's kind of the important thing here. It's not a fixed amount of money. It is a newly rewritten formula to divvy up and decide what districts, what cities and towns need or are going to get. The biggest thing that it does is it addresses the biggest complaint that people have had about this. There are kind of four issues: English language learners, low income students, and healthcare, transportation, issues like that, where the old formula was just not keeping up with the amount of money districts were spending. That has now hopefully been rectified once this bill gets done, so that the state side of that funding will be back up to the expectations that were set 25 years ago when the MCAS reform was put in place and that funding formula was originally written.
Senate President Karen Spilka and House Speaker Robert DeLeo met with Governor Charlie Baker this week to talk about this bill. And the bill overall, I would say from what I've read, has been pretty warmly received. So what did the governor have to say about it?
Not a lot. Baker really kept things close to the vest on Monday when we asked him what he thought about this bill. Like all legislation, the governor usually says that he's looking at it, that his team is reviewing it. There's a lot of lawyers looking at a lot of things, you know, as with any legislation that is proposed. Of course, this is not at his desk yet. This hasn't even been taken up in either of the chambers. But it's what we're going to see about what Baker wants might kind of be revealed through this legislative debate. It's expected that the Republicans in the Senate and in the House may offer amendments to this bill and try to debate aspects of this bill that could shed some light on what Baker wants. Really, the only thing that Team Baker has said about this bill so far is that they're concerned about the kind of strings attached to all of this money. If, you know, it's $1.5 to $2.2 billion, what are the accountability measures for school districts, for teachers, et cetera, that goes along with this kind of cash? If we're going to up the funding formula, Baker might argue that we should also try to modernize some of the accountability things that are around. Now, teachers' unions see this warily, let's put it that way. Never a fan of standardized testing and things like that and the kind of accountability measures that we've seen in the past. Teachers' unions have said that they're going to try to protect against poison pills that could be thrown into the mix, into this bill during debate. And so that's kind of where it stands. And I definitely think that the news coming out of this is going to be about that accountability side and how the governor feels could play out in these Republican amendments.
What are some other groups saying kind of on the left side of the political spectrum? You just mentioned the unions, but what about think tanks and other groups that scrutinize these types of proposals?
They're pretty thrilled, honestly. The Massachusetts Communities Action Network is kind of a coalition of a lot of lefty groups, and they called it amazing. You know, people are calling it a generation of opportunity. They say it's going to really affect the outcomes for, you know, a million students in Massachusetts, a lot in the kind of gateway cities, because the bill focuses on those English language learners and the low-income students. Those districts are going to have access to more resources than they would now. That can only be good news for poor students in Massachusetts. It's as simple as that. So a lot of the progressive groups are very excited about that. But some of these organizations are saying they're going to be vigilant about what kind of, you know, quote-unquote accountability measures might get included by Republicans or kind of lobbied for by Baker when he gets involved towards the end of this legislative debate. Overwhelmingly positive response, but they don't want to see it changed.
Right. Okay. And that kind of brings me back to the governor. Beyond simply either signing this bill or vetoing the bill, how else might he try to influence this process as it goes to debate and kind of gets really scrutinized in the next few weeks?
It's difficult to tell because, you know, he meets with the Senate president and the speaker for an hour and a half about, you know, who knows what in a private conversation, then comes out and says that he's reviewing it. So he may have spent the entire time telling the speaker and Senate president exactly what he wants to see. He could be instructing Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr and House Minority Leader Brad Jones exactly what he wants to see. He's kind of the Republican general in this debate process. The other side of that is more public lobbying. He can use the bully pulpit if he decides not to play it close to the vest. He could tell the press, he could tell the public what he thinks and what he wants to see. And then when it comes to his desk, he can, you know, veto or amend it as he sees fit.
And so that said, what is the timeline for this? I mean, we've talked about bills that have kind of seemed like a win for everyone all around, and then they've just kind of fizzled out. So will this one kind of get stuck in the vortex that's Beacon Hill?
Well, this bill is a little bit different because it was agreed to by the House and Senate leaders before it ever came out. It's still going to go through the process in both chambers and then have to be reconciled depending on what changes they make. But they're starting from the same place, which is rare. So it's going to be taken up by the Senate next week. I think that actually senators have until Friday afternoon, this afternoon, before they can file those amendments. And we'll know exactly what Bruce Tarr, the senator from Gloucester, wants to see in that bill to kind of speak for the Republicans. Those will be debated next week in the Senate, and they will then send that bill over to the House to be taken up probably mid-October or so. If everything goes according to plan, it could be done by Halloween. But again, the education funding formula was a bill that died in final negotiations at the end of last session, and it wasn't revived until now. So it's a touchy topic, but we could see fast action.
That's WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean. Mike, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Great to be with you.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with State House reporter Mike Dean. That is all the time we have today. A busy show. I want to thank all our contributors. We had Sarah Mises-Tan from WCAI in the studio, Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent, and Will Sennett at the Vineyard Gazette. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.